The West Valley Casino is ready to take bets this weekend with a bingo-style facility. But things could change as multiple lawsuits work their way through the system.
We can count on this one going probably up to the U.S. Supreme Court at some point, because whoever loses is bound to go ahead and appeal.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Phoenix is ready to sell you a hotel. Women's professional golf tees off on a new Valley office.
How a newspaper owner may or may not influence its coverage.
And as The Force Awakens, is sci-fi also waking up to diversity?
Science fiction, more broadly, has a long and venerable tradition of thinking through the implications of different types of people on literally on new worlds.
Plus, new guests for an old Phoenix landmark and a tiny desert concert.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. Hope you're enjoying this sunny Friday. There's more to come for the rest of this afternoon. We expect to top out at 70 degrees. Then for tonight, clear with lows in the upper 30s to lower 40s. Then for this weekend, we'll start off warm tomorrow, partly sunny with a high of 71, cooling down to 63 degrees on Sunday. Currently, relative humidity is at 21%, sunny and 65.
Arizona's craft beer industry is worried about a deal involving one of its own. Anheuser-Busch announced a deal to acquire Tempe-based Four Peaks Brewing. Craft Beer Guild Executive Director Rob Fulmer says they're happy for Four Peaks owners and employees, but concerned about the effects of consolidation, especially when it comes to access to local markets.
Each of these stores has a certain amount of shelf space, and that is managed by the distributors. If they're incentivized or they have more Anheuser-Busch products in their portfolio, they're going to more frequently choose those products over our products.
By early next year, Four Peaks should become the sixth operation under Anheuser-Busch's unit focus on craft and imported brands. On its Twitter page, Four Peaks says Arizona is home, and they'll continue to brew in the state.
The Tohono O'odham Nation's West Valley Casino opens on Sunday. It has been and continues to be at the center of controversy. When the Southern Arizona Tribe bought the land near Glendale in 2003, it did so under a different corporate name. When it announced plans to build a Las Vegas-style resort and casino there, critics argued that went against the voter-approved gaming compact of 2002.
That was the subject of just one of the lawsuits that's worked or is working its way through the court system on this tribal casino development. Here to explain where those cases are now is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services.
The tribe certainly would like to open what they call a Class 3 casino. And so there's been this litigation that started years ago with the state suing the tribe, saying you can't do that. You can't have acquired land after we sign the gaming compact and build a casino there. Well, here's the deal. A federal judge looked at it and said, you know, I read the compact, and yes, maybe all of you folks believed that there was no casino going to go there. Maybe even Governor Hull believed that there was no casino going to go there. But in fact, that's what the compact says. That case is now on appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court. They are looking at not only that question, but also the question that Judge Campbell said he could not answer, which is, can the state sue the tribe for fraud? Judge Campbell said they have sovereign immunity there.
So those cases are both still out there?
Yes, those cases are there. Now, there's a separate case that the tribe filed against the Department of Gaming, which is still in Judge Campbell's court, over the issue where the Department of Gaming said, well, no matter what happens to the Ninth Circuit, we're not going to issue the required certification to open a Class 3 casino because we still think you're guilty of fraud, because that was never decided in the earlier case. So the state has come in as now the plaintiff. That case is still being heard. In fact, there is a hearing on that probably in February. The state's response comes in on January 8th, and we will have to decide whether the state can basically be told, no, you can't use your fraud allegation to deny them the license that they contend that they're entitled to.
So basically, there's still litigation as to whether or not the tribe can open the casino in the first place, and then, if they can, what kind of a casino they can run.
Exactly.
The Tohono O'odham Nation has basically won pretty much every time that it's been in court, and it obviously has much bigger plans for this casino and the facility itself. Is there any sense of when any of this might actually get resolved finally?
Well, let's see. You know, this has been going on literally since, since 2002, but actually it sort of ripened in 2009 when the tribe disclosed, oh, by the way, we have this property up next to Glendale. I'm assuming the Ninth Circuit will issue a ruling probably within 2-3 months on that case. As I say, the case that's in the trial court where the tribe is suing the state, there isn't even a hearing date set on that. We can count on this one going, you know, probably up to the U.S. Supreme Court at some point, because whoever loses is bound to go ahead and appeal.
So, Howie, I don't know if you're a betting man or not, but since we're talking about casinos, I feel like we have to at least broach this in some way. What kind of odds would you give the Taunton Otham being able to eventually at some point have the entire facility that they had planned from the beginning?
I'd say the odds are, 70-30 in their favor because of the case law on this, because of what the judge has said. And the only way the state can win on this is by somehow convincing a federal judge and maybe some appellate judges that the fact that the tribe sort of hid what it was doing back in 2002 when voters were being asked to vote on the gaming compacts makes them ineligible to pursue Class 3 gaming now.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. You can find him at the Penny Slots most weekends. Howie, thank you as always.
I'm counting on making it big. That's my retirement plan.
Pending lawsuits aside, the Desert Diamond Casino West Valley is set to open its doors Sunday afternoon. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn has been to the casino and joins me. Casey, what's it look like?
Well, it's just north of Westgate over near Glendale, and it's sort of a low-lying building. There's a big, it's sort of surrounded by agriculture land, which is what it used to be. And right behind it is a pretty big, big field of dirt. So that's where the big proposed $200 million building is going to be. Right now, what they have is 150,000 square foot building, where about a third of that square footage is being used for the casino floor. And I did get to take a tour of that floor. It's sort of looked just like your typical casino. Now it was filled with about 1,000 Class 2 slot machines. Other than that, there's a cafeteria. It's sort of small, but they do have options for food. And there are some areas where you can go cash in.
Now, obviously, this whole complex will eventually, in the tribe's mind, have more to it than this casino. There's a resort that's going to be there. Does this building look kind of odd, just sitting on this big open field of dirt with this one building there with the other stuff not quite there yet?
Yeah, actually, when I first pulled up to it, I really didn't even know if I was in the right place. It's very nondescript. It's just beige, blocky, sort of like looks like a few Legos put together. And even when I asked to go see the front, which we didn't even go in the front, we went in the back, I didn't even know where to go in. And then you see this huge field behind it where, like you said, that resort is going to go in. They plan to build a $200 million resort, actually. Not just a resort, they want a spa, they want a hotel, they want conference rooms, basically anything to sort of bring people and keep them there.
What do casino and tribal officials expect on opening day? I mean, how many do they expect a large turnout there?
Oh, they expect a huge turnout. They said that they've been getting hundreds of calls of people asking when is it going to open. People have been calling Glendale City Council to ask when it's open, and they've been talking to the tribe. I mean, it just seems like they're really going to get a huge amount of people. At 1 p.m. this Sunday is when it opens. It does seem like they're going to get a pretty big group of people coming, and they're planning to have a very big grand opening.
KJZZ's Casey Kuhn. Casey, thank you.
Thank you.
Following months of speculation, the Do Not Disturb sign has been taken off the Sheraton Grand Hotel in downtown Phoenix, and it's officially up for sale. The hotel was built in the depths of the Great Recession in 2008. To learn more, I'm joined by Jeremy Legg, Special Projects Manager for the City of Phoenix. Jeremy, why is now the time to sell the hotel?
The Sheraton Grand Phoenix has been a critical part of Phoenix's tourism and convention infrastructure. And the way that the hotel has been performing this year, 2015 has been the hotel's best year ever. The operations have really stabilized. The hotel's making money. We have great business both at the hotel and in the convention center over the next couple years. And the market is just such that it really makes sense for the city to pursue a hotel sale right now.
What would the city be looking for, both in terms of the type of company, what sort of history they would have, and the type of money, if you can tell me that as well?
The good news is whether the city continues to own the asset or not, it's going to continue to provide a benefit to the community of being this really vital piece of tourism convention infrastructure. However, if we are able to sell the asset, then that just opens up a whole new window of opportunities for our mayor and city council to consider reinvesting in our community. And as you know, anytime anyone owns any type of asset, there are opportunity costs. And by freeing up the capital associated with the hotel, that simply gives the community more options for its future.
If you find a purchaser that the city is happy with, are we talking lump sum? Are we talking interest payments over the course of a number of years?
The city's open to a variety of offers that the market might want to bring to the table here. We're really only looking for entities that have experience operating full-service, first-class, large hotels. It's an important piece of our downtown and convention business, so we really want to make sure it gets into the hands of an entity that really knows how to effectively and efficiently operate such an asset. We want to be open to what the market be able to offer, but we do want to focus on entities that have access to $300 million.
Are you looking for someone who not only can do a good job managing a hotel, but that is also a good community partner?
I think a partner is a very good term. I think that whoever ends up taking the hotel off of our hands is going to be somebody we're going to be working with indefinitely going through the future. The 1,000-room hotel is literally just a block away from the doors of the Phoenix Convention Center. And so our guests here at the city's convention center are also going to be guests of the Sheraton Grand Phoenix. So it's very important that the entire experience of our delegates and guests be a positive one from start to finish.
Does the sale, though, indicate that the city itself was not the best entity to manage a hotel like that because the city itself didn't necessarily have that kind of experience?
Yeah, what was important to the city was that the convention hotel be developed. Now that it is, there's really no reason for the city to be a long-term owner. Again, now that it's making money, we're not in a fire sale position where we have to get out of it immediately, but we really do want to find that right partner that, of course, is going to offer a reasonable sales price, but also is someone we know is going to do a good job operating it. But there's no reason we need to continue to operate it now that it's open and fully functioning and it's proven to be an effective asset.
Have you gotten any buzz so far? Is there a feeling that even if there haven't been any formal talks, that there is a lot of interest out there?
Oh, there absolutely is a lot of interest. I've gotten a lot of calls and a lot of emails, and we have a lot of information sharing going on right now. So the market is apparently very interested in this.
Right, and not a lot of people just randomly have $300 million available, so I presume you're getting some legitimate calls on that as well.
It is. You're right. There's a relatively small world of investors who have this kind of experience and financial wherewithal, so I'm confident we'll be able to get to a place that makes sense for all parties involved.
Still to come, brain injuries can change patients in lots of different ways, including magnifying traits they already had.
For me, being just straight out of the military, I was very structured and very organized, and that magnified it. So now I am, some people will say that I'm overly efficient, where I disagree and say I'm just very efficient.
That efficiency will be put to the test. The story's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Checking Valley traffic, accidents I-17 southbound at I-10. That's blocking the off-ramp. There's also a collision I-10 eastbound at 51st Avenue. Valley weather for the rest of today will stay sunny, looking for a high temperature of 70 degrees. And then for tonight, clear skies with lows in the upper 30s to lower 40s, and we'll start the weekend tomorrow with partly to mostly sunny skies and a high of 71. Currently, relative humidity is at 18%. It's sunny and 69 at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
The Force is strong in my family. My father has it. I have it.
The Force awakened with a vengeance last night as the newest Star Wars film drew passionate and casual followers alike to theaters across the country and around the world. Critics are saying the movie is reminiscent of the original trilogy that came out in the 1970s. One element that is quite different, though, is the diversity of the cast. The leads include a British actor of Nigerian background, a woman, and a Guatemalan American. Joining me now to talk about the impact of that is Michael Bennett, associate research professor in the School for the Future of Innovation and Society and the Center for Science and the Imagination at ASU. Michael, how do you interpret the diverse approach in The Force Awakens?
There are at least three ways to think about the diversity dimension of the film, or dimensions, really, of the film. On the one hand, or first, there's just the cultural and political moment that we're in. Even though the Star Wars narrative takes place in a distant past, it's conflated with future-oriented science fiction. And as a vision of the future, it has political significance. In effect, it implicitly endorses the presence of certain types of people in certain types of positions and in certain types of contexts. And as a central element of American culture, as well as global culture, that's meaningful and important. Science fiction, more broadly, has a long and venerable tradition of thinking through the implications of different types of people in new types of situations, literally on new worlds. And so we shouldn't be surprised in the 21st century we see a very diverse set of actors and characters.
How vital is that to broadening people's perspectives who may see it and just broadening the general popularity?
I think it's absolutely critical. It's essential, even. Science fiction has always had a didactic impulse. It wants to teach us what can be. In some ways, it's radically unconcerned with the empirics of the world around us. It wants us to think about how the world could be, what desirable futures might look like. And in some ways, in its highest and best forms, we could even understand that it is nudging us towards those futures.
Looking back at some of science fiction, this is more than a couple of decades ago, but the original Star Trek TV series was given some credit for being more diverse in terms of its casting. Are there certain examples to you that come about, you think of, well, this is a good example of where diversity in science fiction really came together on a higher scale?
It's really interesting that you mention the original Star Trek television series, because there's a great anecdote about race and politics and diversity connected to it. Nichelle Nichols has gone on record as saying that about halfway through that show's very short, I think it was only three seasons, that show's very short run, she was thinking about leaving the show. She was unhappy for various reasons. She goes home, the phone rings, she picks it up, and it's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the phone saying to her, first of all, that he's so happy with her presence there. Secondly, that's the only television show that he allows his family to watch. And third, that she can't leave the show because her presence there represents black people, black Americans specifically, in the future. And in that sense, the show plays a vital political role. And I think that's really what's at stake here from a political and a cultural perspective. When you have television shows and movies that, in effect, engineer or fabricate visions of the future, it's foolish to not think that those visions would contour the imaginations of people, both very young and very old, and help them think about what type of future they might want to live in, perhaps even create.
Michael Bennett, thanks for coming in.
Certainly, my pleasure.
Michael Bennett of ASU's School for Science and the Imagination.
Roosevelt Row is getting a new coffee shop. It's expected to open late next month. That's not necessarily unique. The area already has a number of places to get your morning fix. But OSB, or Oliver's Sophisticated Bean, will be a bit different, mostly because of its owner, Oliver Bryan. After getting out of the Navy, he was invited to be part of a flag ceremony at a Cardinals game. On his way home from that event in October of 2012, his motorcycle hit a dirt embankment. He flew more than 30 feet and landed on his head. Bryan says he always wears his helmet, but wasn't that night. He suffered a severe traumatic brain injury and was in a coma for a month and a half.
The last thing I remember was at the football game. I remember doing the flag ceremony, and I remember meeting or seeing one of my family's friends. They were getting food, and I remember that. That was the last thing I remember before my accident.
Did you have plans to do something outside the military, and you'd just gotten out of the Navy? Did you have a sense of what you had wanted to do?
I was trying to pursue my school. I was going to use the military GI Bill benefit and go to schools and pursue my architecture degree.
So what led to the change from doing that to now opening a coffee shop? And what happened to lead to that change?
Well, after I was accepted into Center for Transitional Neuro Rehabilitation Center, and there they had me start going back to school. So I was taking architecture classes, but I just didn't have the passion for it anymore. And I've always loved coffee. And when I was in school, I would go to coffee shops all the time. And they were like, oh, sorry, we're closing. You know, I'm like, this is 5 o'clock. What do you mean you're closing? And so this was like an issue. I was like, I need to be a coffee shop that allows students to go there and study all night and work and do what they need to do. That's why I have extended hours or open late.
Why do you think it is that you didn't have the passion for architecture anymore?
Coffee was calling my name.
I mean, do you think it was related to the brain injury that you suffer, that maybe something happened either in your brain or maybe just emotionally that like it was something that you had been tied to your past that you just didn't want to pursue anymore?
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure of why I didn't want to pursue it anymore. But I will say the brain injury did change me in the sense that before my brain injury, I was a very mean, cold, selfish person. After my brain injury, because where I hit in the brain controls your personality, and I'm completely not the same person anymore. My family will say, like, yes, you're still the same Oliver, and we're sitting right next to you, but you're not. You're not the same Oliver.
In addition to sort of the physiological changes of where you hit your head and how your brain actually changed, do you think that having gone through that has changed you in other ways?
Oh, absolutely. Brain injuries either water down or magnify certain characteristic traits of that individual. So for me, being just straight out of the military, I was very structured and very organized, and that magnified it. So now I am, some people will say that I'm overly efficient, where I disagree and say I'm just very efficient, where I literally schedule my day out down to the hour, what I'm doing each hour. And just to be honest, that's a compensation I use, because as a brain injury, you have to develop compensations to get through life.
Obviously, you know this, but being a small business owner is not an easy job. I mean, it can be kind of an all-consuming proposition. Given the kind of medical history that you now have, is there anything about what you're embarking on that concerns you?
I would say the biggest would be overwhelming myself and trying to take on too much and not like allowing myself to develop these compensations to kind of fill the gap of where I can't do. So that would just be overwhelming myself and not being smart about the way I go about things.
Oliver Bryan, he suffered a severe traumatic brain injury in 2012, but is set to open a coffee shop, OSB, late next month along Roosevelt Row. His recovery has been dramatic, but what about other patients who suffer brain injuries? Dr. Pamela Klonoff works with these patients. She's a clinical neuropsychologist at Barrow Neurological Institute.
It will really depend on a variety of factors, including the nature and the extent of the brain injury. So brain injuries fall across the spectrum where they can be very mild, all the way to moderate, which is more of a significant injury, to a very severe injury. Obviously, the more severe the injury, then the more the difficulties are that the patient can have, and it can be across a spectrum of physical problems in terms of moving their body, their balance, their coordination. It can be thinking changes, and then a whole host of emotional and interpersonal difficulties. So the journey that someone takes will very much depend on that set of factors, as well as other things, like you've mentioned, you know, is the person motivated to improve, which generally patients are. I mean, they want to get back to some semblance of having a meaningful life. The role of family support and community support is also really instrumental in terms of the gains people will make.
Is something like PTSD a consideration for some of these patients?
It certainly can be. It tends to be more in a situation of a milder injury where the person will have a recollection of the events of the accident or the trauma. Our patients that have these moderate to severe injuries don't remember the actual events surrounding the injury because of the loss of consciousness.
Does that in some way complicate their getting back to normal if they don't really remember why it is that they had this incident in the first place?
It can, and part of the process of working with patients is helping to give them insight and what we call psychoeducation. So even though they won't have a recollection of the actual event or the accident, which in some ways is probably a good thing because of the trauma associated with that, what we're trying to do is give them knowledge about, well, here's what did happen in the accident, but also more importantly, you know, what's the nature and extent of the brain injury? What are the areas that are affected? What does the future hold for you in terms of how to best navigate through life with the difficulties that the person may be having?
Yeah, I wonder how big of a factor frustration is that patients, even if maybe they don't remember the specifics of the accident or the injury, they know that their speech is different than it was before, or their memory is different than it was before, and they're just frustrated by that.
Absolutely. That is a really key part of what we try to address. Part of the treatment model that we have here is all patients are involved in individual psychotherapy as well as participating in group psychotherapy. So as their awareness builds and they understand more about the effects of the injury, particularly some of the difficulties and challenges, there can be a concomitant increase in their emotional distress.
Is it desirable to get patients back to the life they were living before their accident, or is that too painful or just too difficult for them?
You know, that's a really good question. And again, it goes back to what we want to do is help the patient accept the circumstances that they have and then help them make what we call realistic goals and aspirations for the future. So if it is realistic to go back to the same type of work, for example, that an individual had prior to the injury, then our treatment model here will help them actually make that transition to work and will actually assist them in that regard. But if it's no longer a good fit and it's going to be overly challenging or frustrating or it's not going to be a successful experience, then part of the goal of therapy is to help them find a different direction where they can still have a sense of job satisfaction and meaning, but where they're going to be successful and productive.
Dr. Pamela Klonoff is a clinical neuropsychologist and director of the Center for Transitional Neurorehabilitation at Barrow Neurological Institute. The Ladies Professional Golf Association has signed a multi-year lease on an office in Scottsdale. The LPGA plays a tournament in the Valley each spring, but recently decided to make Scottsdale the home of its sixth satellite office. Scott Wood is one of the people who will work there. He's the tournament director of the JTBC Founders Cup, which is scheduled for March in Phoenix. Scott, why did the LPGA decide to expand to the Valley?
Phoenix is such a golf mecca, and you know, one thing that the LPGA is, as we grow, we wanted to make sure that we had a presence here in the Valley, and you know, and Scottsdale, importantly, is just one of those hubs that for the golf, and for not only for golf but for lifestyle and just the overall golf community. So we are centrally located in Scottsdale to the course and to our team members. So it's a good fit for us to be able to implant ourselves into the community and for us to become a a presence in the community, not only during tournament time, but also, you know, throughout the year and 12 months.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because obviously the LPGA has a presence here in the Valley, has had one prior to you having a permanent office. So what do you think this will allow you to do that maybe you weren't able to do before?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's going to allow us to be able to do more things and be able to get our message out to more groups. And hopefully what overall what we're trying to accomplish here, not only put on a world-class golf tournament, but also become a community player that is able to help grow the game, not only just in the women's community, but also in the girls' community. And we do that through girls' golf program. So it allows us to play a bigger part with the girls' golf community, be able to add more resources to the local chapter here in Phoenix. And, you know, overall, it's going to allow us to be able to expand and be able to grow this tournament and, you know, and not just be somebody that comes in every March.
There have been reports for a little while now about how some golf courses are struggling. There might be fewer people playing golf here in the Valley and elsewhere. Does the LPGA think that by increasing its presence here in the Valley, it might be able to stem that tide or reverse it somewhere? Or does it see women's golf and girls' golf as maybe an area of growth?
Definitely. It's the women's and girls' side of golf is, I mean, it's probably the biggest opportunity for golf to grow. And especially out here, you know, on the West Coast and in Phoenix, it's a market that predominantly probably in this area is more resort focused. And it's an area that where a lot of the community golf courses where, you know, a lot of the people that haven't gotten into golf have an easier access to get into with the community and with the public courses. So I think it's one thing that, you know, when our tour comes to town, it's something that we can definitely open up and show the community that maybe not be the golfing community that there are opportunities for them to get out and play golf. And ultimately that should help, you know, domino effect into being able to, you know, have a lot of these courses around to be able to sustain and be able to thrive.
You think that this increased presence from the LPGA might be able to help some of the courses that have been struggling financially, help them maybe stay open and keep operating?
I don't know if we're the determining factor of that. I just think that with us being coming in and having a more of a 12-month presence, I think that we can garner more attention for golf, for that non-golfing community. And for us to be able to do that, get more girls involved in girls golf and get more women involved who, you know, in the business community that see probably their male counterparts going out and playing golf and doing business, you know, that's one thing that if we can open those doors and provide them opportunities to just experience it a little bit more, maybe that will help. And maybe that will help to, you know, some of the outlying courses that might be struggling might be able to help them sustain.
Scott Wood is Tournament Director for the JTBC Founders Cup, talking about the LPGA's new satellite office in Scottsdale. Scott, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a moment of musical balance.
I think about a song like a room. You sort of like feng shui the room. You need to have everything in its right place, and you don't want it to be too crowded, but you definitely don't want it to be too minimalist.
A tiny desert concert up ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It is the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, a few trouble spots. I-17 southbound at Northern, a crash has the right lane blocked there. 143 southbound, there's a disabled vehicle blocking the left lane at I-10. Also on I-17 southbound at Pinnacle Peak Road, a crash has the exit ramp there blocked. We're looking for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. It's sunny right now, 69 degrees at KJZZ at 237.
KJZZ is supported by Live Nation, presenting Bill Maher. Stand-up comedian, television host, and political commentator, live at Comerica Theater on April 10th. Tickets on sale this Monday at 10 a.m. Ticketmaster.com.
It's called the Professional Building. You might recognize its Art Deco facade in the middle of downtown Phoenix. It was built in the 1930s as the Valley National Bank of Arizona and made famous in Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 film Psycho.
But for the last 30 years, it sat largely empty until today. Now, as the revitalization of downtown Phoenix hits full steam, a new hotel is opening in this historic building. The show's Lauren Gilger got a look inside.
going to be the Hilton Garden Inn Phoenix downtown.
Michelle Davis, the hotel's general manager, is standing in the cavernous marble lobby of the professional building. Construction crews are finishing plaster work and artwork is being hung on the walls.
We have just finished rebuffing all of the floors in the main lobby. All of the original marble floors have been restored. And, you know, they're just really putting the finishing touches on laying the granite and the stonework in the elevator corridors and all of those original pieces, bringing them back to their glory at this point in time.
The Art Deco skyscraper was built in 1932 and once housed the Valley National Bank of Arizona. Now, after almost a year of renovations, the public is about to see the building again for the first time in decades.
And the real crown jewel of the building is the Grand Banking Hall space, which was, you enter that off Central Avenue and you go into this large two-story volume space, which has a lot of its original Art Deco articulation.
Roger Brevoort is a historic consultant on the project.
Most people have no idea that this space exists. And I think we bring back to the community a sense of formal banking lobby that was lost.
His firm helped get a federal historic tax credit for the project and worked with the architects to make sure they have stayed true to the building's historic features and fabrics.
How much of this is actually original?
Quite a bit. The important spaces inside are the main entrance lobby off Monroe Street and the elevator lobby with the elevator doors and then the marble floors, the marble walls. All of that original material.
Brevoort has actually been involved with this building since the 80s when he helped get it listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Since then, the professional building, as it's called, has been through round after round of owners and developers.
There was the era when the McDonald's was in the lobby.
But no full-scale renovation ever came to fruition.
And as we watched downtown Phoenix sort of come back around, it's like, well, when is somebody going to be able to figure out a solution that makes the professional building work?
Then in 2006, it seemed like the professional building's luck was finally turning around when a developer purchased it and began renovations to make it into a hotel.
Until the financing imploded and the project was shuttered.
The recession hit and again, the building sat empty.
And now as downtown Phoenix revitalization is sort of taking hold, isn't it great to be bringing back a key asset right in the middle of downtown?
It's actually a really cool little hidden place. This area used to actually be where the bank manager used to sit and look down and overlook the lobby when it was in its original splendor.
The new Hilton Garden Inn has 170 rooms, 2,600 square feet of meeting space, and eventually it'll have a rooftop bar. Davis said it's all come together faster than she thought possible.
It's a really cool building, and I think we're just like amazed to be where we are at this point in time.
Now, as the finishing touches are put on the building, she said she's anxious to fill it with guests.
I am so ready for them to come back and to see people in my lobby and fill this lobby with noise the way that it was originally supposed to be. And I think when I hear that, I will feel complete.
And to Brevoort, it's a project that's been 30 years in the making.
It's just sort of a great, you know, career kind of achievement to see this building back in play, in action, restored, you know, intact. And I've been involved with it for so long that it's just a very exciting time. And I can't wait to sit at the bar and have a drink and get back.
Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The newspaper business has taken a plunge in the past few years. Some prominent papers have moved exclusively online, while others have folded. So the purchase of the Las Vegas Review-Journal as part of a $140 million cash deal earlier this week stopped the presses. Even more attention is being paid to the transaction now that it's been revealed that outspoken billionaire Sheldon Adelson is the man behind the agreement. To learn more, I'm joined by Rick Edmonds. He's the media business analyst for the Poynter Institute. Rick, how significant is the sale price?
I think one significance of that is that from the seller's point of view, especially since the seller in this case is a publicly traded company, when you have an offer that big, you'd really be letting the shareholders down not to take it. But then I certainly also see the point, which has appeared in some coverage of this, that it suggests that Mr. Adelson wants the property for prestige, influence, political agenda, whatever, as opposed to a straight business proposition.
I think the influence and the political agenda part is what has certain people sort of shaking in their boots about something like this. How does this compare, I guess, when we think about the impact that he can have? Is that something that people who would read that newspaper, people who work in a newsroom, should be concerned about?
Well, I think it's certainly a reasonable concern, but I would add that I wouldn't necessarily find him guilty before he does anything.
Okay.
In fact, having a partisan agenda for a newspaper, particularly in what it chooses to report, is very much the exception. And dating way back into the early part of the 20th century, I think most publishers realized that kind of an axe grinding approach to news is going to chase off readers, and that's definitely not something you want to do in the current difficult business climate.
You could probably put this in a better historical perspective than I could, but I think of William Randolph Hearst, and we think about other people where there was a feeling that there was an editorial board, and if you went to the op-ed page, you would see what the paper and perhaps what the publisher thought of what was going on in the world, but the rest of the paper
right.
maybe didn't reflect that. Is that something that maybe we can expect to see when you talk about perhaps influence that someone like Sheldon Adelson will want that to show up in his editorial page, but other than that, it'll just be run like a normal journalistic paper?
That's an excellent question. I think one thing that sometimes happens, and in fact, I think you may have seen it in the sort of editing out of a few comments in the very first stories about this, is that the people running it assume that the guy on top would be offended and may do some of that sometimes. So-called self-censorship, that can be a problem.
When you talk about Adelson being a businessman, there is a thought that if, in fact, he would want to keep the paper for a while and want to keep it going, if people see it as being above board and journalistic, maybe they'd have a tendency to stick with it more than if they thought it had a particular agenda, because as a businessman, it might hurt him in terms of making money if people don't want to buy the paper anymore because they don't trust it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And some other billionaire buyers, that would include a man named Glenn Taylor in Minneapolis or John Henry in Boston, Jeff Bezos at the Washington Post, given their wealth, they may be willing to operate at break even or even incur a few years of operating losses.
Any signs you'd watch for over the next 6 months to a year or something to see what sort of patterns we're seeing from the Review Journal or anything that might stand out mm-hmm. to you as an observer of this business?
Well, that's a good question, too. And I would be surprised if, beyond perhaps assuming that the paper will endorse a candidate in the Nevada primary, which has been fairly important and maybe more important this year. But it really depends on whether there's some action that pretty clearly reflects a exerting influence in a way that's doubtful ethically. I do think it's quite a good sign that after a little quote being edited out in the first story, the Review Journal pursued this story pretty aggressively.
That is pretty interesting, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, investigating who your own owner is going to be. Pretty interesting.
Right.
Rick Edmonds is media business analyst at Pointer. Rick, thank you for the time.
Sure. Enjoy talking. Thanks.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, a crash at Union Hills has the right lanes blocked. A little bit further south, I-17 southbound, the right lane at Northern is blocked. Sunny skies, 69 degrees at KJZZ at 2:48.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, celebrating the 8th annual Subaru Share the Love event, which has contributed more than $65 million to charity. Shop Subaru.com.
It's been sitting in the middle of an empty lot for more than 30 years. From a distance, it may look abandoned, but it isn't. Its doors are open once a year for the community. The show's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us the story of a Phoenix church.
West of Sky Harbor Airport near Buckeye Road and 16th Street is an industrial complex. In the middle of it all is a small building on a 19-acre lot. It's the Sacred Heart Church. Did you know Sacred Heart Church is only opened once a year for Christmas Day service?
When you come out on Christmas Day to our Mass, you'll see people kneeling in the fields here. They go to the spot where their house used to be and they'll sit there and they'll kneel and they'll pray.
Abe Arvizu Jr. is a member of the Bronze Sacred Heart Center, the organization that oversees the saving and restoration of what is known today as the Old Sacred Heart Church. He grew up in the neighborhood.
Yes, I was right over here in the corner. you know, maybe a block away, block and a half away.
Sacred Heart closed about 30 years ago, but every December, Arvizu and other former parishioners make their way into the church to clean it up in preparation for Christmas Day Mass. Inside, Arvizu reminisces about this building in the area once known as the Golden Gate Barrio.
The homes went from all the way to the river bottom, all the way to the airport, all the way to 7th Street, and all the way up to the railroad tracks. That was the neighborhood.
Sacred Heart Church was built in the predominantly Mexican-American community in 1952 with the help of Father Albert Braun. He was a decorated chaplain of both World Wars. He arrived at Golden Gate Barrio, realized services were held under a Ramada, and decided to build a church. Help came from everywhere, including from the community eager for a place to worship of their own.
Pennies and nickels and dimes. That's what they were gathering up that was left over to continue the building.
And many families even donated bricks from their own property. After all the collections, a church big enough for about 300 parishioners was built. Unique features adorn the inside. The ceiling lights are the 1915 chandeliers that once hung at St. Mary's Basilica. The altar floor and the altar are covered in Italian marble.
You think that's beautiful? Walk over here and look at the mosaic on the wall.
The mosaic is of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, but the building does have its problems.
See, you can see the termite damage. That's from all the years of, you know, the treatment not being done.
Around the 1970s, the city of Phoenix imposed an eminent domain on the area for industrial development and airport expansion. Old Sacred Heart Church stands today because of community petitions and support from some city council members over the years, preventing its demolition. Old Sacred Heart and the land it sits on is owned by the city of Phoenix. Every year, the city agrees to open its doors on Christmas Day for noon mass. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you have ideas or know things that we should know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org.
And now for a tiny desert concert. That's when we bring local bands to play a couple of songs and talk a bit about the music. Today we hear from Christina Moore of the band Foreign Language. The group has a unique sound. It's soft but rich and ethereal but substantive. We asked Christina to describe her own music.
This question's always so hard for me. I would have described it as some sort of experimental folk, not so much reflected in these particular songs, but in our current music, I'm using more guitar, more like electric guitar and things like that. So it's just sort of become experimental.
Yeah. Your instrumentation, and again, I know you're evolving on this, but it's fascinating because ukulele, drums, and then this sort of interesting keyboard, but then there's sort of this interesting electronic piece that I'm not sure. I wonder if you could describe it for us.
The Omnichord?
Yeah.
It's this really neat product of the 80s.
I should have recognized it. Sorry.
It's supposed to simulate an auto harp. So it's set up like an auto harp. And then it's got a sensor that you strum, and it's got this really nice like harp sounds that it plays, and then these like bass notes that you can turn the chords up on so those drone out.
But you're playing the ukulele.
I am.
And what appeals to you about the instrument and the sound it gives you?
Initially, what appealed to me was that it was four strings, and I was not good at stringed instruments. I was a piano player. I played accordion. And so, like, jumping from things like that to the ukulele was very different. So I ended up just having one. It was just, like, out of convenience and because it was less challenging than a guitar. And so now, moving on to guitar, it's different because that's what I've always preferred, I suppose. So there is no cool story as far as like what I like for the sound. That's why I run it through so many pedals and reverb and stuff. I'm like trying to make it a guitar and it's a ukulele. So,
So Christina, why don't you guys play a song for us?
Sure. Yeah, this song is called Wax Indignant.
Strides. Here they come like hot sweats in the night. Fortune follows those who follow through, but I'm always saying never do. I'm trying to be bolder.
awkward to simply sit in silence. If we just wax indignant, does that make us better friends? I don't mind if you take your time, your time, your time, your time.
What really stood out to me is, you know, there's that sort of dreamy nature, if you don't mind that word.
Oh, yeah.
And the harmonies, of course, as well. So dreamy, what do you think about that description? Do you think it fits?
I think it's great. Yeah, I like to try and juxtapose dreamy with droney. And that's why we have, you know, like things like that Casio that we use and other elements like that in our recorded album and stuff. I wanted to have this sort of like ethereal nature, but also like something almost ugly or darker to sort of counterbalance it.
Well, so is that a mood you're aiming to get listeners to feel?
Sure. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd like to think that a lot of our songs are very contemplative and can... It's actually a funny story. This guy, I was playing at Changing Hands, and this guy asked me why I write such sad songs. And I was actually really bummed because I never thought they were sad. I like the idea of having, yeah, like they can be very... very dark, but also like there's a lot of other emotions that I want to evoke when writing. So
your lyrics to me had, there's a complexity to them. I'd almost, they're profound in a sense as well. And they're also very literate. I mean, these are not sort of standard themes necessarily. And I think that makes a person sort of dig in deeper to want to listen to it. I mean, is that what you're aiming for as well?
Yeah, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
I definitely, that's what I'm aiming for. I want to cover a lot of ground lyrically. And sometimes I'm always afraid it becomes too like labyrinthine. You know, people can't pull a lot out of it because it's just like, what is she talking about anymore?
There's a balance though between that dreamy or drony aspect you're talking about, and then the lyrics that go with it, because it's almost like there's a darkness or a heaviness to the lyrics and a thoughtfulness to it, and yet it comes in a package of sound that is actually fairly easy to listen to in the sense that it doesn't feel quite as threatening or pounding, but you get a chance to listen to the music, and then when the lyrics come in, you don't feel overwhelmed necessarily because it's a nice blend.
I think about a song like a room. And you sort of like feng shui the room. You need to have everything in its right place, and you don't want it to be too crowded, but you definitely don't want it to be too minimalist. And so it's like a song is almost like a physical space that you occupy with all of these things. And so the lyrics, I would hope, yes, would definitely balance out with whatever sort of tones and quality of sound that we're gaining from the instruments and things like that.
Christina, thanks very much for bringing Foreign Language in. Why don't you take us out on the next song?
Sure. This song is called A Conversation After Dinner. Off your shadow, we hung away from.
I've been talking with Christina Moore of the band Foreign Language. You can see video of this and other Tiny Desert concerts by visiting kjzz.org/tinydesertconcert. And if you're in a band or know of one that you'd like to hear play a Tiny Desert concert, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
If you're looking for something to do this weekend, you can check out the legendary Count Basie Orchestra. It'll be performing tomorrow afternoon at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts.
And something, Mark, you will not be able to take part in because I've never seen you wear this. It's the ugly sweater run tomorrow morning at 10 at Tempe Beach Park. This is a well-dressed man, folks.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I just don't own a lot of sweaters. I mean, we live in Phoenix. We don't have a lot of use for sweaters here. You can also check out Leanne Rimes. She'll be performing tonight at Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Rebozova, and Tiara Vian.
Sky Shadow and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Skywalker Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Good story ideas, send it our way. The show at KJZZ.org. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.